Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I shall be continuing my narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic, and specifically the career of Julius Caesar, and specifically the portion of his career where he's invading Gaul over many, many years. So let's just continue the story. If you remember last time, we left off at the end of the year 56 BC with an indecisive campaign against the Marini. So the next year, 55 BC, this is the year where Caesar has incursions across the Rhine, i.e. into Germany, and into Great Britain. I mentioned before, I've done a little bit of content before, a while ago in the old studio, all about Caesar in Britain. Well, it wasn't all about that, but we talked about it a bit. So we'll go into it in more detail this time. And that does cover pretty much the whole of the year, 55 BC. So first of all then, just to say, what it looks like Caesar is doing, or what Caesar is doing, is he's conquered Gaul, nominally. Lots of rebellions have risen up, he's put them down, and now he's trying to sort of shore up the edges, trying to make sure he doesn't have any big incursions, firstly from the Germans, really. The Britons are a whole different kettle of fish, but just trying to make his position, the Roman position in Gaul, as safe as possible, and it's still far from safe. So first of all, he tells us about a giant massacre of the Usipetes and the Tencteri, both German tribes. So once again, this is the year 55 BC, and he tells us this, quote, "In the following winter, in which the consulship of Pompey and Crassus began, the German tribes of the Usipetes and the Tencteri crossed the Rhine in large numbers not far from its mouth. They were forced to migrate because for several years they had been subjected to harassing attacks by the Suebi and prevented from tilling their land." So the Suebi are certainly one of the biggest, but definitely one of, if not the most warlike of the German tribes. I often think of the Suebi as sort of one of the inner core, or one of the most important Germanic tribes. So if they're on the move, or if they're doing some sort of large-scale offensive operations, then it's really something to have to deal with. Caesar goes on here. "The Suebi are by far the largest and most warlike..." Oh, yes. There he goes. Caesar says exactly what I just said. "The Suebi are by far the largest and most warlike of the German nations. It is said that they have 100 cantons, each of which provides annually 1,000 armed men for service in foreign wars. Those who are left at home have to support the men in the army as well as themselves, and the next year take their turn of service, while the others stay at home. Thus both agriculture and military instruction and training continue without interruption. No land, however, is the property of private individuals, and no one is allowed to cultivate the same plot for more than 1 year." So something a little bit communistic there, like diggers, communal land, there's no private property. One other thing I'll say before I continue is that this is Caesar's account of the Germanic peoples is among the first ever literary count of them. Later, quite a lot later, 150 years later plus, Tacitus writes the Germania, which is another account. So Caesar talking about both Britain and Germany, it's some of the earliest material. And he says they don't really have much private property or any real private property. He says, "They do not eat much cereal food, but live chiefly on milk and meat and spend much time in hunting. Their diet, daily exercise, and the freedom from restraint that they enjoy, for from childhood they do not know what compulsion or discipline is, and do nothing against their inclination, combine to make them strong and as tall as giants." That's another thing that always comes up. The Germanic people, particularly the Germanic people across the Rhine, are just big, physically big men, big and tall. And the Italians find that disconcerting or disquieting. Caesar continues, "They inure themselves, in spite of the very cold climate in which they live, to wear no clothing but skins, and these so scanty that a large part of the body is uncovered, and to bathe in the rivers." There's a certain type of person, isn't there, who doesn't mind swimming in very, very cold water. It's not my cup of tea, but some people go out of their way to swim in mountain lakes and rivers and things, don't they? I'm sure it is very invigorating, probably quite good for you, but in short doses. But I'm not a fan of that sort of thing. So anyway, it does make you hardy, though, doesn't it? It's not for the faint-hearted, Caesar goes on. "Traders are admitted into their country more because they want to sell their booty than because they stand in any need of imports. i.e. he's saying there Germany is sort of fairly resource poor. They haven't got many things that other people want to buy. Even horses, which the Gauls are inordinately fond of and purchase at big prices, are not imported by the Germans. They are content with their homebred horses, which, although undersized and ugly, are rendered capable of very hard work by daily exercise. In cavalry battles, they often dismount and fight on foot, training the horses to stand perfectly still so that they can quickly get back to them in case of need. In their eyes, it is the height of effeminacy and shame to use a saddle, and they do not hesitate to engage the largest force of cavalry riding saddled horses, however small their own numbers may be. They absolutely forbid the importation of wine, because they think that it makes them soft and incapable of enduring hard toil. It's not that they don't like booze, but just not specifically Roman wine, Mediterranean wine. They regard it as the proudest glory of a nation to keep the largest possible area around its frontiers uninhabited, like a dead zone, because it shows that many other peoples are inferior to it in military might. It is said, for example, that on one side of the Suebic territory, the country is uninhabited for a distance of more than 550 miles. End quote. So, yeah, they have this idea of dead zones, that if you've got your tribe, in order to show that you're the master of all the surrounding territory, you completely depopulate it. And the bigger this dead zone is, the more powerful you are. Yeah, so the Suebic one is massive. They didn't really imbibe the maxim of love thy neighbour. The narrative goes on, quote, on the other side, their nearest neighbours are the Ubi, who were once, by German standards, a considerable and populous nation. They are somewhat more civilised than the rest of the Germans, for living on the Rhine close to the frontier of Gaul, where traders visit them regularly, they have adopted Gallic customs. The Suebi, after repeated attempts to oust them from their home by force of arms, found them too numerous and strong to be dispossessed, but compelled them to pay tribute and greatly reduced their pride and power. The Usipetes and Tencteri were in the same case. For many years they withstood the Suebi's pressure, but eventually were driven from their country, and after wandering for 3 years in many parts of Germany, reached the Rhine in the territory of the Menapi, who had lands, farmhouses and villages on both banks of the river. Terrified by the arrival of such a multitude, the Menapi abandoned their dwellings on the German bank and placed outposts on the Gallic bank to prevent the emigrants from crossing. The Germans tried every expedient, but not having boats with which to force a passage and being unable to cross by stealth because of the Menapian pickets, they pretended to return to their home country and marched in that direction for 3 days. Then they turned back again and recovered the whole distance in a single night. Their cavalry made a surprise attack on the unsuspecting Menapi, who, on being informed by their patrols of their enemy's departure, had fearlessly recrossed the Rhine and returned to their villages. The Germans slaughtered them, seized their boats, crossed the river before the Menapi on the Gallic side knew what was afoot, took possession of all their farmhouses, and lived on their provisions for the rest of the winter. These events were reported to Caesar. The unstable character of the Gauls made him anxious, for they are easily induced to form new plans and generally welcome political change, and he thought it better to place no reliance on them. It is a custom of theirs to stop travellers, even against their will, and to question them about what they have heard by chance or by inquiry on this or that subject. And in the towns, a crowd will gather around traders and demand to know what country they have come from and what they have learnt there. Such hearsay reports often induce them to make momentous decisions, which they are bound to repent immediately afterwards, since they credulously swallow unconfirmed rumours, and most of their informants invest such answers as they think will please them. So Caesar's saying the Gauls are a bit credulous, really, almost childlike, a bit too quick, impetuous, low impulse control, and too trusting and naive. You know, a combination of things which aren't very good, make you foolish, really. Caesar continues. Caesar was aware of this habit, and not wishing to find himself faced with a dangerous war, set out to rejoin his army earlier in the season than usual. On his arrival, he found that his suspicions were correct. A number of tribes had sent embassies to the Usipetes and the Tencteri, inviting them to go further afield than the Rhineland, and promising to supply all their requirements. So Caesar's spidey sense was tingling that he thought the Gauls, still unhappy with being conquered by the Romans, of course, might induce the more warlike German tribes of the Rhineland to help them out. And it seems that that's exactly what happened. So Caesar's spidey sense was on the money. He continues his narrative saying, "This attractive prospect had induced the Germans to range over a wider area, and they had now reached the country of the Eubones and the Condrusi, departments of the Treveri. Caesar thought it advisable to say nothing to the Gauls about the information he had received. Summoning their leaders, therefore, he addressed them in soothing and reassuring terms and told them to furnish cavalry for the campaign which he proposed to conduct against the Germans. After arranging for his corn supplier and making his selection of the cavalry, he marched towards the district where the invading Germans were said to be. He was a few days' march away when envoys arrived from them with the following message. 'We Germans are not taking aggressive action against the Roman people, but we are ready to fight if provoked, for it is our custom to resist any attacker and ask no quarter. We wish to say, however, that we have come into Gaul not from choice, but because we were expelled from our homes. If you Romans desire our friendship, we can be of service to you. Either grant us land to live in, or let us keep what we have won by the sword. The only people whose superiority we acknowledge are the Suebi, with whom the gods themselves cannot compete.'" Caesar might have something to say about that. They go, "There is no one else on earth that we cannot conquer." And that's the end of the Germans' message, and Caesar's narrative goes on to say, "Caesar made what he considered a suitable reply to this oration, but the upshot of his remarks was that there could be no friendship between him and the Germans if they remained in Gaul. He said that it was not reasonable for men who had been unable to protect their own territory to expect to occupy other people's. There was no land available in Gaul which he could justly assign to them, particularly in view of their large numbers. But they might settle, if they chose, in the country of the Eubi, whose ambassadors were then with him, complaining of the wrongs done by the Suebi and asking for assistance. He would order the Eubi to admit them." The German envoys said that they would refer Caesar's reply to their countrymen for consideration and return in 3 days. In the meantime, they asked him not to move his camp any nearer. But Caesar refused this request also. He knew that a large detachment of their cavalry had been sent across the Meuse some days before to the country of the Ambivariti in search of corn and plunder, and he thought that they must be expecting these back and that this was their reason for trying to gain time. The Meuse rises, that's the river Meuse, the river Meuse rises in the Vosges Mountains in the country of the Ligones. It is joined by a tributary from the Rhine called the Waal, making the island of the Batavians, and flows into the Rhine some 75 miles from the sea. The Rhine rises in the country of the Lemponti in the Alps, and flows swiftly for a long distance through the lands of the Helvetii, Sequani, Triboci, Nantes, Mediometrici, and Treveri. As it nears the sea, it divides into several channels, forming a number of very large islands, many of them inhabited by wild barbarian tribes, some of whom are supposed to live on the fish and bird eggs, and discharges itself by several mouths into the North Sea. When Caesar was not more than 12 miles from the Germans, their envoys returned according to agreement, and meeting him on the march, earnestly begged him to advance no further. On Caesar's refusing to comply, they asked him to send word to the cavalry, which had gone in advance of the column, forbidding them to engage in battle, and also requested leave to send an embassy to the Eubi. They said that if the Eubian chiefs and council would swear to keep faith with them, they would avail themselves of the offer that Caesar had made and ask for 3 days to complete the necessary negotiations. Caesar believed that all these suggestions had the same object as their previous manoeuvre, to obtain a further 3 days' delay to give time for the return of the German cavalry from their foray. So Caesar suspects they're just playing for time, and they have got every intention of meeting him in combat at some point. However, he said that he would restrict his advance that day to 4 miles, the distance that was necessary to get water. On the next day, if as many of them as possible would assemble at his halting place, he would give their requests a formal hearing. In the meantime, he sent orders to the officers who had gone on in front with the whole cavalry force that they were not to attack the enemy and, if attacked themselves, were to remain on the defensive until he approached with the main army. So Caesar trying to accommodate them, you know, it's not just a complete brick wall like dealing with Attila the Hun or Genghis Khan. It's not that, right? But he also, Caesar's, he's not a fool, is he? He's the opposite. He knows what's going on almost certainly. And he's not going to leave himself open to any sort of sneak attack or anything like that. But still, he's not hell-bent on, at this point, on massacring them all or anything. So, you know, it does sound like he's trying to, you know, trying to give them some sort of degree of benefit of the doubt. But they're really not to be trusted. He goes on here, quote, "But when the enemy caught sight of our cavalry, 5,000 strong, although they themselves had not 800 horse, those who had crossed the Meuse to get corn, having not yet returned, they immediately charged. Our men, who thought themselves safe from attack because the enemy's envoys had only just left Caesar and had asked for a truce for that day, were at first thrown into disorder. When they rallied, the German horsemen, following their usual practice, jumped down, unhorsed a number of our men by stabbing their horses in the belly, put the rest of them to flight, and kept them on the run in such a panic that they did not stop until they came in sight of the marching column of infantry. In this engagement, 74 of our cavalrymen were killed, including Piso, a gallant Aquitanian of a very good family, whose grandfather had been king of his tribe and had been granted the title of friend by the Roman Senate." So not one of the Roman Pisos, I take it, just somebody else who happens to also be called Piso. "He went to the assistance of his brother, who was cut off by some of the Germans, and succeeded in rescuing him, but his own horse was wounded and threw him. As long as he could, he resisted with the utmost bravery, but eventually was surrounded and fell covered with wounds. When his brother, who by this time had got well away from the fight, saw what had happened, he galloped straight up to the enemy and let them kill him too. After this treacherous and unprovoked attack by an enemy who had asked for peace, Caesar dismissed all further thought of giving audience to their envoys or attempting any overtures. At the same time, he thought it would be sheer madness to wait till they were reinforced by the return of their cavalry. The Gauls were so scatterbrained that even this single German success had no doubt made a great impression upon them, and they must not be given time to concert plans. He told his generals and quaestor of his decision, and not wanting to lose a single day in bringing the enemy to battle, marched forward. The next morning, he had a great stroke of luck. Still pursuing their policy of treachery and deceit, a large deputation of Germans, comprising all their leaders and elder men of note, came to visit him in his camp. Their ostensible object was to apologise for attacking the day before in contravention of the agreement they had themselves asked for, but they also hoped to hoodwink Caesar into granting an extension of the truce. Caesar was delighted that they had put themselves in his power and ordered them to be detained, while he himself marched his whole army out of camp, with the cavalry bringing up the rear because he thought it had been demoralised by its recent defeat." End quote. So once again, Caesar, you're not really going to fool Caesar. Not very often, and certainly not for very long. He's savvy. His political and particularly his tactical sense is razor sharp. I suspect these German leaders thought they were hoodwinking Caesar in some way. You can only imagine they would have thought, they would have calculated that the absolute worst thing that could happen, which they didn't expect would happen, but the worst thing that could possibly happen, is that they would be detained and Caesar would just keep marching straight forward. And that's exactly what he does. It's a classic thing in war, isn't it? Just do the thing that is going to be the worst thing for your enemy. Whatever is the worst thing, no matter how much it costs you, if you do that, it will throw them into disarray. That's how Caesar rolls. He continues the story here. Quote, "With the soldiers formed in three parallel columns, ready for wheeling into line of battle, he made a rapid march of 8 miles and reached the enemy's camp before they realised his intention. The speed of his advance and the absence of their leaders combined to throw them into a sudden panic. They had no time to think what to do or to arm themselves and were too distracted to decide whether it was best to march out against Caesar, to stay and defend the camp, or to flee for their lives. The Roman soldiers could tell that they were afraid by their cries and hurried movements, and spurred on by the recollection of the previous day's treachery, burst into the camp. Those of the Germans who were quick enough in seizing their weapons resisted for a time, fighting under cover of their wagons and baggage. But there was also a great crowd of women and children in the camp, for they had brought all their families with them when they left home and crossed the Rhine. These began to flee in all directions and were hunted down by the cavalry with Caesar sent out for that purpose." Bit harsh, isn't it? Bit harrowing. You know, it's things like that where some people that criticise Caesar, they have got things like that to point to. But there you go, it's the ancient world. They had a completely different set of rules and morality and ethic than we do. the story goes on. Hearing cries behind them and seeing that their people were being massacred, the Germans threw down their arms, deserted their standards, and rushed out of the camp. When they reached the confluence of the Moselle and the Rhine, the Moselle, another river, they realised that they could flee no further. A large number were killed, and the rest plunged into the water and perished, overcome by the force of the current in their terror-stricken and exhausted state. The Romans returned to camp without a single fatal casualty. I wonder if that's quite true. And with only a few wounded, although a grim struggle had been anticipated against an enemy 430,000 strong. Caesar gave the prisoners detained in camp leave to depart, but they were afraid of being killed or tortured by the Gauls, whose lands they had ravaged. They said they wished to remain with him. They were allowed to retain their liberty. End quote. So that is almost a scarcely believable story. 430,000 usurpates and tectori seen off, not massacred to a man, but largely massacred and the rest completely defeated with zero fatalities for the Romans. Could have happened, just, you know, seems a bit unlikely. If anywhere, Caesar might have exaggerated a very small number of casualties, it might be there. But still, when you catch your enemy completely in disarray and they just flee, they're doing nothing but fleeing, it might be possible, even if there is some exaggeration there. Either way, it's just one more tick in the column of Caesar doing away with giant enemies really quickly and really easily. Just one more example of it.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.